Hello, Silver City and Grant County. You are listening to Earth Matters on your Gila Members Community radio station, KURU 89.1 FM. You can tune in to Earth Matters every Tuesday, Thursday, and Sunday at 10 a.m. and Thursday evening at 8 p.m. on 89.1, as well as listen to podcasts of each show at gmcr.org. This is what your community radio looks like and sounds like. My name is Nathan Newcomer, and I'm the Gila Grassroots Organizer for the New Mexico Wilderness Alliance, and I'm your host for today's show. The New Mexico Wilderness Alliance is a nonprofit organization dedicated to the protection, restoration, and continued enjoyment of New Mexico's wild lands and wilderness areas, especially our beloved Gila. On today's program, I would like to welcome back Judy Kalman, staff attorney with the New Mexico Wilderness Alliance. Judy moved to New Mexico in 2001, inspired by a lifelong fascination with the West. After completing degrees in biology and philosophy and working on several political campaigns, she realized her true passion to be environmental policy. She completed her law degree at the University of New Mexico, as well as a master's in environmental law and policy at the Vermont Law School. Welcome to Earth Matters, Judy.
Thanks for having me, Nathan.
So we've had you on the program a couple of times talking about Mexican gray wolves and something called the McKittrick policy, which most people probably don't even know what that is. Can you give our listeners kind of a refresher on what the McKittrick policy is?
Sure. The Endangered Species Act actually creates a couple of misdemeanor crimes that are federal criminal penalties. And these occur when somebody harms or harasses a listed species in a way that interferes with its breeding, sheltering, or feeding. And when somebody commits one of those misdemeanors, they're supposed to be held criminally liable by the federal government. And the penalties for that are outlined in the act itself. And so if it's a listed endangered species and one of them is harmed, it's supposed to be 1 year in jail and a $50,000 fine for each individual that is harmed or killed. And if it's a threatened species, it's half of that, so 6 months in jail and a $25,000 fine. And so the Mexican gray wolf is a listed species, but it's actually a 10J species, which means it's an experimental population down here in the Gila. So it's treated as a threatened species.
Even though it's endangered.
Right. But because the population is an experimental one, the penalties associated with harming them are the same as a threatened species. And so it's supposed to carry a $25,000 fine and a 6 month in jail penalty if any of them are harmed. Probably hear a lot. Mexican wolves are shot and killed quite a bit. It's by far their highest cause of mortality. There have been over 60 Mexican gray wolves down here that have been illegally killed since 1998.
60?
Yes.
Wow.
And when you consider that there's only 113 currently in the wild, that's kind of a lot. So it's a high cause of death. And so we started noticing a long time ago that even when Mexican gray wolves were killed and the Fish and Wildlife Service had a suspect and turned those files over to the Justice Department, who's responsible for actually prosecuting federal crimes, the Justice Department was declining to prosecute those people, even when they knew who they were. And so we started digging into this a little bit more and realized that every person who got away with killing a Mexican wolf used the same excuse. And that excuse was, I thought it was a coyote or I thought it was a dog. And so we dug in a little bit more and found out that the Justice Department actually created this policy by itself that said that unless they could prove that a person knew the exact biological identity of the species that they were harming, they were not going to be prosecuted for endangered species violations. And this is a nationwide policy, so this policy applies to every endangered species.
When did that policy go into effect?
It went into effect in 1998, which just coincidentally happens to be the same year that the Mexican gray wolves were reintroduced, but they're not related.
The irony.
Yeah, it just happened to work out badly for the wolves. So this seemed to us to be illegal for a couple of reasons. One was that the Department of Justice was pretty blatantly not listening to the Endangered Species Act itself, which it's mandated to do because it's a law that Congress passed. So Congress, you know, instituted these penalties and said when they would occur. And that did not include having to prove that the person knew the species. It's traditionally been a general intent crime, which just means that people had to act voluntarily and an endangered species had to have been harmed. And that was all that was required for prosecution. And so DOJ kind of thwarted the intent of Congress by changing that requirement. So that was the biggest problem. But The other problems were that they did not consult with Fish and Wildlife Service when they created this policy. Fish and Wildlife Service is the agency that's responsible for actually managing endangered species, and the Endangered Species Act requires that any agency that might harm an endangered species has to consult with Fish and Wildlife Service before they do it. And so they didn't do that.
Did anybody at Fish and Wildlife Service know that this was going on?
Yes, that's a good follow-up question.
Okay.
Once I tell you.
Okay, we can wait. We can wait.
Only because it's a larger conversation. But the other thing they didn't do properly was the policy. So those were the three things that we thought were wrong. Fish and Wildlife Service did become aware of it pretty early, and the agency has always been very opposed to DOJ having this policy. And actually, a former Fish and Wildlife Service director, Jamie Rappaport-Clark, actually formally asked the U.S. Solicitor's Office a long time ago to get rid of the policy, and they declined to do so. So, you know, Fish and Wildlife Service's policy sort of varies from administration to administration like
sure.
everything else does. But they have been relatively outspoken about their dislike of this policy because it eliminates the deterrent effect of the penalties. So it makes Fish and Wildlife Service's job of managing endangered species a lot harder when everybody sort of knows at this point that all they have to do is say they thought they were killing something else and they're not going
right.
to go to jail. And it's extra crazy because it applies nationwide. So as we were digging into this, we were finding files of people who had shot grizzly bears and said, oh, I thought it was a black bear, and people who shot condors and said, oh, I thought it was a turkey vulture. And so, you know, the criminal deterrent effect of the whole law has been sort of negated by this policy.
So why was it called McKittrick policy? What does that stem from?
So it was just named after a guy named Chad McKittrick, who in 1995-ish shot and killed a gray wolf in Montana and hid its body and buried it somewhere. And through an investigation, his friends who were with him ended up turning him in. And Fish and Wildlife law enforcement went and found the body of the wolf, which had a collar, and the collar was destroyed. And at that point, McKittrick himself said, oh, I thought it was a dog. And even though there had been many years of case law with endangered species penalties that said you don't have to know what species it is, so courts had concurred with Congress that you didn't need to prove biological identity, McKittrick decided in his defense to challenge that. And so he lost because the law was pretty clear that you didn't need to do that.
Right.
And then he appealed his conviction up to the Ninth Circuit and lost again. And he was getting ready to appeal it to the U.S. Supreme Court. And in the middle of briefing it, the U.S. Justice Department kind of just wrote a memo
just
to the Supreme
in.
Court. Well, it was them who were prosecuting because that's their job. But in between the Ninth Circuit and the Supreme Court, they wrote a memo to the Supreme Court and said, actually, we're going to accept that as a defense from now on. And so the U.S. Supreme Court never heard the case and declined to do it. So what's interesting is that because the Ninth Circuit appealed, you know, he had appealed to the Ninth Circuit and they had confirmed his conviction. So he actually did spend like 3 months in jail or something for killing this wolf. But the upshot of it is that this whole policy is now named after him because the Justice Department made that change during his appeal process.
Do we know why the Justice Department stepped
no.
in? We still don't know. So you dug around. You did a lot of digging. You talked with some other lawyers, some other environmental lawyers about this. And we ended up suing the U.S. Department of Justice, right?
Yes. We filed a lawsuit in May of 2013, which is quite a while ago now. In federal district court, we actually filed it in Tucson, Arizona. And we alleged mostly the two parts about them not consulting with Fish and Wildlife Service and not, you know, letting it be publicly reviewed.
And is this pretty rare to see environmental groups challenge the Department of Justice on memos and policies like this?
Yes. As far as I know, it might be the only time.
Really?
I mean... I don't know every case that's out there, but I don't know of another one.
So tell us what ended up happening. Like, we sued the Department of Justice, and it took many years for us to go back and forth with them on certain things. And
yes.
What's that process been like?
Well, slow. It's been slow even for an environmental lawsuit, and environmental lawsuits are often slow. But in 2015, which was about 2 years after we started, we survived a motion to dismiss, so that was sort of the first hurdle where DOJ said there shouldn't even be a case. And Judge Burry, who happens to be a George Bush appointee, said, no, there is a case. We're going to keep going. So that was good. That was successful. And then right after we survived motion to dismiss, a lot of other groups intervened in the case, which is when, you know, an outside party who wasn't at the start of the case decides to join the case on behalf of one of the two sides. And if they can show that they deserve to join, then the judge often allows them to. And so New Mexico Cattle Growers, Safari Club International, New Mexico Farm and Livestock Bureau, and I'm missing one.
That's
okay. A similar group, four of them, actually intervened on DOJ's side successfully. And so now it was us against DOJ and all those groups, which also is probably unprecedented. So all of that happened in 2015. And then the next step in the process was a summary judgment. And so that's kind of where the court can decide, yes, there's a case, but it's so obvious that we don't really have to talk about it. And it's just going to go to one side. And we actually won on that motion. And if a judge decides that a party wins on summary judgment, that's the end for that court. And so we found out this year that we actually won at district court on summary judgment. So we got a great opinion from Judge Burry. It was awesome. It said that the McKittrick policy was a total abuse of discretion by the Justice Department. So it was a huge, huge victory. I think a lot of people were not expecting it. Sometimes I was not expecting it. So it was a nice surprise. So it's awesome. And they talked about the whole McKittrick policy's impact to endangered species all over the country. The judge talked about the responsibility of a hunter to know its target, which was a really important part of Fish and Wildlife Service Mexican wolf recovery rule from a long time ago that they put in the rule itself, saying, you know, anyone who's shooting a gun out in the Gila needs to know the difference between a wolf and a coyote and that it's the person holding the gun who has a responsibility to know. Actually, NRA guidelines even say that you have a responsibility to know your target. So it's not crazy. So we were totally thrilled. And then we found out a couple of months ago that they actually have appealed, DOJ has appealed the case to the Ninth Circuit.
Well, we can talk a little bit more about that in our next segment. You are listening to Earth Matters on KURU, and we'll be right back after a short break. Welcome back to Earth Matters on your Gila Members Community Radio Station, KURU 89.1 FM. My name is Nathan Newcomer, and I'm your host for today's show. We are talking with Staff Attorney Judy Calvin of the New Mexico Wilderness Alliance about all things Mexican gray wolves and the McKittrick policy, which was an internal policy memo by the Department of Justice to not prosecute individuals who unknowingly killed endangered species or threatened species. So, Judy, can we pick up where we last left that conversation at the end there of talking about the Department of Justice is now appealing this decision that was issued?
Sure. Can I clarify something you just said really
quick?
Please
do.
I wouldn't say it's that they unknowingly killed them. It's when they killed them on purpose and say that they didn't. So people who claim mistaken identity, but it's still provable that they acted knowingly.
Thank you for clearing that up.
So, yes, they are appealing it. We did file it in Arizona, which is part of the Ninth Circuit. And so it's going to go up to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. All of those intervening parties appealed also. So we're in the middle of that briefing schedule right now. DOJ has to file their appeal brief in mid-October, and then our response will be due in November, a month later. And then we'll see where it goes. You know, a lot of the case law that we relied on for the district court case that we won was Ninth Circuit case law. And the Ninth Circuit can't really overturn itself. So hopefully, unless there's a procedural problem, we'll be okay at the Ninth Circuit. But we'll see.
Could it go beyond the Ninth Circuit? And if it did, would that be the Supreme Court? Or is there another level before that?
Nope. Only three steps. So that's it.
So that's pretty exciting.
It's pretty exciting. You know, like I said, it would have been sort of nicer if they hadn't appealed at all and we could have just let the district court decision stand. And it's been confusing to me about why DOJ has held on to this policy so tightly, because the policy itself, it sort of requires them not to prosecute. But what we were asking for by asking for the overturning of this policy was sort of just to give them their prosecutorial discretion back. So we weren't asking for a requirement that they prosecute everybody who kills a Mexican wolf or an endangered species. We were just wanting them to remove the barrier that they had put on themselves. So essentially, we were giving them more freedom by overturning the policy, because the policy restricts their ability to prosecute. So it's been confusing to me for a long time about why the administration has held on to it so tightly. And it, you know, we started this during the Obama administration, and they also defended it. So it's interesting because it doesn't seem like getting rid of the policy would affect them that negatively.
Do you have any sense of where this might go from here, or would you not want to speculate on that?
It's really hard to speculate. You know, if we had a friendlier administration in the White House to our issues, I would say that it would be worth targeting them to just voluntarily rescind the policy through the Justice Department and the U.S. Attorney. That's not going to happen during a Trump administration, so we'll have to ride it out through the courts. But, I mean, like I said, the Ninth Circuit tends to be relatively good, and the case law that we relied on for the district court win is Ninth Circuit law. And so usually a circuit court can't overturn itself.
Yeah, so, I'm kind of curious about that. So if the Department of Justice and the other parties, like the Livestock Bureau or what, all those other groups, if they appealed, who'd they appeal to? Like they appealed within the Ninth Circuit?
What do you mean?
Like what I don't understand is you said that these groups appealed the decision, right?
Right.
So who did they appeal to?
They appealed to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals.
To the Ninth Circuit because the decision came from one judge? Is that?
Yeah. So the district court, it's just one judge who makes the decision.
I see.
You kind of get randomly assigned to a district court in that district.
I see.
So we got Judge Burry in Tucson. And then if you appeal up to a court of appeals, like each state is assigned to a circuit. And so Arizona is within the Ninth Circuit. And so then at the court of appeals level, you get a random panel of three judges. And DOJ had to appeal first.
Okay.
The other intervening parties couldn't have appealed without DOJ appealing. So DOJ appealed, and then the other parties filed notice also.
I wonder if it would have been interesting to see if Obama was still in the White House, if they would have appealed this decision or not.
We've been speculating about that, too. And like I said, I mean, in that situation, I think it would have been worth it to try to have a grassroots effort to just get them to get rid of it. But that's not an option anymore.
And can you just one more time explain what's the next steps, the timeline?
So DOJ has to file a brief outlining their reasons for appeal with the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals by October 18th.
So next month, 2 weeks, basically.
Yeah, we got a briefing schedule really fast. I mean, I'm no expert in how this works, but given how slowly the district court case went, this one seems to be going pretty quickly. And then we have 30 days to file a response.
I see. So we'll keep up the great work and keep monitoring that. And if there's any late breaking news, we'll want to get you back on to talk about McKittrick policy.
But we should not lose sight of the fact that it was really exciting to lose to win the district court case.
No, I agree. When you sent out an email about it to everybody, it was pretty shocking. Like you said,
bit of a letdown with the appeal, but we should still be excited.
Yeah. So let's transition just a little bit away from this policy on McKittrick to Mexican gray wolf recovery plan more generally.
Sure.
There was a new Mexican gray wolf recovery plan issued. When was that?
In June, I think.
Of this year?
Of this year.
And I've heard sort of mixed reviews about it. I've heard some people say, well, there's some good things in it. I've heard some people say there's some bad things in it. Then I've heard some people say there's actually horrible things in this and it should be rewritten and start from the drawing board again. Where do you stand on that?
I think it's pretty bad. Just for procedure's sake, it is a little bit confusing just because the Fish and Wildlife Service has had so many documents come out relating to Mexican wolves. So they have a wolf management plan, which incidentally we're also in litigation about along with pretty much everybody else under the sun. So this was the management plan was how they're going to manage the wolves on a daily basis. And that came out in 2015. This new plan that came out is a recovery plan, which is a requirement of the Endangered Species Act, and it's supposed to outline the steps to actually get the animal off the endangered species list. So it's kind of like, what are the end goals that need to happen to make it so that this species doesn't have to be listed anymore? So it's kind of, there's two separate plans out there, so I don't want to confuse people.
So what's a little different from the recovery plan is trying to address how do we get the wolf off the endangered species
list. Like what constitutes recovery?
Right. So how's that different from the management plan?
Well, they should be interrelated.
Okay.
And really what should have happened was they should have done the recovery plan first and then done a management plan. They happened not to do that. They did this recovery plan. The last recovery plan was in 1982, I think, which was the year I was born. So it's been a while. And this plan was a settlement that they agreed to as a result of separate litigation that we were not a part of. So as part of settling this separate litigation, they agreed to do this recovery plan by this November. And so they have been ordered by a judge, the Fish and Wildlife Service, to finish it by then. So, you know, the reasons that it's not great, we think, is it doesn't seem to be listening to the best available science, which is a requirement that Fish and Wildlife has when managing endangered species. And so there has been a large scientific panel of wolf biologists for a long time, and Fish and Wildlife Service disbanded them a few years ago. But before they were disbanded, they came out with a bunch of papers about what recovery might look like. And as far as we know, that's the best available science.
Whose science are they listening to?
Well, it's interesting. A variety, but not that. And we're pretty sure that the best available science is these papers written by this scientific panel collective. They have some internal science. They're listening to some state science, but they're not listening to this panel. And what this panel said was that the minimum number of wolves required for recovery would be 750. And it would be 750 in three separate populations that were connected by corridors. And you want flow between the U.S. and Mexico, which brings in the whole border wall and a whole bunch of other issues. And what this recovery plan is saying, this draft recovery plan, it's not finalized, I should say, it caps the population at 325 wolves, which is half of what this scientific panel says is really needed for recovery. So that's one major issue. The other major issue is that it completely relies on Mexico to further Mexican wolf recovery, like the country. But the United States can't tell Mexico what to do and also has a separate obligation for endangered species recovery, regardless of what other countries are doing, because we have our own law that says that we have to. And so it sort of marks recovery by what's going on in Mexico through Mexico's recovery plan. So that's not great either. And there are a couple other small problems, but those are the big ones.
Now, the recovery plan, didn't it also expand the boundary of, like, sort of the wolf recovery zone?
You're thinking the management plan.
Okay, so I am confused on this.
But, yes, there is a proposal to expand from just outside the little wolf recovery area that's essentially the Gila and the Apache Sitgreaves National Forests to I-40 and the U.S.-Mexico border, and then basically the eastern border of New Mexico and Texas and the western border of Arizona and California. Oh, and there is one more major problem that I didn't mention about the recovery plan, which is that it gives a lot of discretion to the state of New Mexico, which is problematic when you have an administration like Martinez's who's been openly hostile to wolf recovery.
Yeah.
So it gives our state game commission authority over when wolves are released and how many are released, which is hugely problematic.
So did you say that we're in litigation for both the management plan and the recovery plan?
No. We're in litigation for the management plan because you can't litigate until a rule has been finalized.
I see.
And the recovery plan is still in its draft form, so they don't have to finalize it according to this court settlement until this November. So once it's finalized, we'll all have to have a discussion about what to do. But for now, we're just in the advocating for a better decision phase.
And where are we at in the litigation with the Mexican wolf management plan?
It's going very, very slowly. It's been briefed and argued. It was argued in April. We're sort of just peripheral, our organization, in that. There's about 25 parties that have all been combined together into one giant conglomerate of a lawsuit because it's all the conservation groups, all the farm and ranch groups, and New Mexico, Arizona, Colorado, and Utah. So it's a big case, and it's going to take a long time.
And what are the main sort of arguments from our perspective about why this plan, the management plan for Mexican wolves, is pretty bad?
It was the same kind of arguments, that they didn't listen to current science. They were capping the population. Another really big problem with the management plan was that it didn't consider, so a 10J population,
which
under
the
endangered species.
Experimental population.
Right. So under the Endangered Species Act, Fish and Wildlife has authority to create these experimental populations where it's just what it sounds like. They can throw some of the animal into the wild and see how it goes. And if they're doing that, it can either be designated as non-essential or essential. And so non-essential is when losing that entire experimental population would not result in the death of the species. An essential population that is experimental would mean that if you lost the entire wild experimental population, the species would go extinct. And so we had argued for a long time that the Mexican wolf population out here should be considered an essential population because it's the only wild one, and it's extinct in the wild. Sorry, not extinct in general. But that's exactly what these Mexican wolves are. They're the only wild population, and if you lost them, there would be no more Mexican wolves in the wild.
Right.
So part of that management rule was that they did not consider essential status. So we thought that was a problem. It also allowed for increased kills of Mexican wolves when they were attacking livestock and a couple other things that aren't specifically outlined in the Endangered Species Act. So it was a bunch of things.
You are listening to Earth Matters on KURU 89.1 FM. We'll be right back after a quick break. Welcome back to Earth Matters on your Gila Members Community Radio Station, KURU 89.1 FM. My name is Nathan Newcomer, and I'm your host for today's show. We've been talking with Judy Kalman, the staff attorney with the New Mexico Wilderness Alliance, about Mexican gray wolves and a lot of policy that's been going on with Mexican gray wolf management, Mexican gray wolf recovery. And I'd like to switch gears a little bit, Judy. You mentioned in that last segment something about the state of New Mexico not particularly being helpful when it comes to trying to prevent the extinction of the Mexican gray wolf. Can you sort of give us a primer first on how the state of New Mexico has been involved or not been involved in the recovery of the Mexican gray wolf over the last, say, 20 years or so?
Sure. So the Endangered Species Act has a section on state cooperation, and it outlines how a state can be a cooperating partner to endangered species recovery. So for a long time, we were a partner as the state of New Mexico with the Fish and Wildlife Service in helping with wolf recovery in the Gila. State of Arizona remains a cooperating partner with Fish and Wildlife Service. But when Susana Martinez was campaigning, she expressed her opposition to Mexican wolf recovery and said that we were going to pull out of the wolf recovery program as a cooperating state as soon as she became governor. And that is what she did. And so that means that we are no longer actively participating as a state through our Game and Fish Department in wolf recovery.
Even though the wolves are running around the state of New Mexico, or more precisely, here in the Gila.
Yes. So it means our Game and Fish Department, you know, can't help Fish and Wildlife Service with data collection or reintroduction, but it also means that we're not always getting, as a state, critical information from Fish and Wildlife either. It's a problem.
So what's been going on lately? I've seen things in the media where the rancher Ted Turner, who owns a lot of private property up adjacent to the Gila National Forest, wanted to release wolves so that they on his property so that they could go into the Gila, but the Department of Game and Fish stepped in and said, no, you can't do that. How can they do things like that if they've removed themselves from the entire equation?
So it gets a little bit complicated, but the Department of Game and Fish is governed policy-wise by a commission of seven people. It's called the New Mexico State Game Commission. And those seven people are all political appointees by the sitting governor. And so the sitting governor can appoint seven people upon becoming governor to that commission, and then that commission creates wildlife policy for the state. So it's a little bit weird because that means that wildlife policy changes like a lot depending on who the governor is. But we can talk about that a little bit in a little bit. So those seven people have jurisdiction over all wildlife in New Mexico except for listed species. Because once a species is listed on the Endangered Species Act, it becomes the jurisdiction of the federal government. Because it's a federal law. So it's a little bit wonky. But Mexican wolves are under the purview of the Fish and Wildlife Service. The Game Commission thinks that it still has some power over state land and private land, which of course it does in general, but maybe not with regards to a federally listed species. And so where they have tried to assert their authority has been on things like private land, private permits, controlling what the State Game Commission can do. And the last couple of years, they've also tried to control Fish and Wildlife Service. So what you're talking about Ted Turner's ranch, is a few years ago, they decided, I'm going to lose the details, but it was something like the commission decided, you know, this is all Susana Martinez's commission, so they plan accordingly, you know, do what she says, I guess. But they said that if a private entity was breeding predators for purposes of eventual release into the state, that they were going to have to get a permit from the State Game Commission. I think that's what it was. And then there are only three species that are currently being bred in New Mexico that are predators that are being bred for ultimate release. And it's the river otter, the black-footed ferret, and the wolf. And the river otter and the black-footed parrot got their permits approved, like, right away from the Game Commission. And then permits were sought to continue. It was just for breeding, I think, as long as they were being bred for eventual release. And the commission said no to the wolf permits. So they've continually sort of done weird things like that. You know, it's not even really clear that they had the authority to give themselves permit-granting power, but they did. And I can't remember if that's being challenged right now or not. But the other thing they've tried to do is try to get Fish and Wildlife Service itself to seek permits from the state for releasing wolves onto federal land.
But they have no jurisdiction for that.
That's
right?
What we think. So this is something they did last year. Fish and Wildlife Service was getting ready to release a couple more wolves into the Gila, and the State Game Commission said, no, you need to ask us for a permit first. So Fish and Wildlife, for whatever reason, said, okay, we'll ask for a permit, even though it was pretty clear that a state agency doesn't have authority over a federal program on federal land that's paid for only by federal money. But they asked, and the commission said no. And what ended up happening, this was a year and a half ago, was that Fish and Wildlife said, well, you don't have authority to require us to get a permit, so we're going to release wolves anyway. And at that point, the state of New Mexico sued the Fish and Wildlife Service.
This seems like utterly shocking to me. Because,
it's crazy.
Right? I mean, so I'm not the only person here that thinks this. So the state of New Mexico has recused itself, essentially, from any involvement whatsoever in the management of Mexican gray wolves in the state of New Mexico.
Yes.
But at every single turn, the governor, the current governor, Governor Martinez, and the New Mexico Game Commission have been trying to intervene and sort of like just poke Fish and Wildlife Service at every chance they can get. Is that what's basically going on?
And then
on
once Fish and Wildlife, you know, asserted its own authority to do this without state permission, the state sued the feds about wolf releases, which is still ongoing, which is our other lawsuit, which we can talk about. But yes, it is totally crazy.
Well, let's talk about that because that's a nice segue.
Well, the state basically took it to federal court and said that the Fish and Wildlife Service can't do this without a state acquiescing to having wolves here. And they're litigating that. And so we actually intervened on that case
on behalf of Fish and Wildlife Service,
which, you know, I mean, we're not opposed to the Fish and Wildlife Service. We just want to advocate for wolf recovery in the best way possible. And, you know, sometimes Fish and Wildlife is doing the right thing and we want to defend them on it. And so that also is still ongoing. So that, surprisingly, the state sought a preliminary injunction at the district court level, which would mean that Fish and Wildlife Service would be barred from releasing any more wolves until the substantive issues were litigated. And they actually got that preliminary injunction last year. The district court granted it. And that, just the injunction piece, went up to the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals. And the 10th Circuit reversed it and said, that's not an appropriate use of a preliminary injunction. So Fish and Wildlife, and this is so critical because Fish and Wildlife Service only has a very narrow window that they can successfully release wolves. So an injunction, even if it's just for 6 months or whatever,
right,
could potentially screw up wolf releases for 2 years. So it's pretty critical that they not be barred from releasing wolves in the interim. So that preliminary injunction thankfully got overturned. So Fish and Wildlife is able to release wolves right now while that's all being litigated. But as we mentioned before in the other segment, this draft recovery plan that just came out gives the Game Commission authority over wolf releases. So Fish and Wildlife Service, on the one hand, has been saying, we don't need your permission. But then they came out with this draft recovery plan that says, well, we don't need your permission, but you can have control over all the wolf releases. So that's
undermining
their own.
You
see the problem.
They're just undermining their own objectives.
Right. So that's why, you know, we need to correct these issues in the recovery plan and also make sure that they don't win in this court case.
I you know, I knew it was a mess. I didn't realize it was this much of a mess.
It's a mess.
It really is a big mess.
And, you know, why would Fish and Wildlife Service have any faith that the Game Commission has any interest in wolf recovery?
Well, of course. You just look
obviously
at their track record.
They don't. They've never said anything that they support wolf recovery. Granted, we're going to have a new governor in 2 years, so we'll have a new Game Commission, which might be interesting. But you can't count on that. And the next time there's an unfriendly administration, there would be a new Game Commission. So, and we don't have sufficient wildlife laws at the state of New Mexico to guarantee some continuity about endangered species management. And Fish and Wildlife Service does, because there's federal laws that regulate that stuff. And so leaving it up to the commission is a horrible, horrible idea.
So besides litigation that we're involved, what other things are we doing to try and bring a positive light to this situation?
That's a hard question after I've just talked about litigation for 40 minutes. There are some advocacy opportunities. So Fish and Wildlife Service continues to have some public comment periods about wolf recovery. They just had one that ended. I'm sure they'll have another one soon. Calling Fish and Wildlife Service, calling your elected officials is always helpful. We have been talking about trying to do potentially a reform bill at the state legislature that would get at some of the pendulum swings in policy of Game Commission. So kind of changing how the Game Commission operates and is appointed might be a good idea. So we're looking at other policy ways besides litigation to kind of advance wolf recovery and other endangered species recovery.
Yeah, so is there a way that we could work with, like, say, local state senators and representatives on legislation that could somehow make an impact on this? And if we could, like, what would that look like?
You know, we need to encourage the new governor, whoever that is, to rejoin the Mexican Wolf Program as a cooperating state. That's a good first step. We would need to advocate with whatever Game Commission is there to be supportive of Mexican wolf recovery in various ways. And then, you know, there's this bill that we talked about. We had one last year that would have altered how the commission is appointed. So instead of all seven being with the governor, three would have been with the governor kind of at large, and then the other four would have been appointed by the legislature. And those four appointed by the legislature would have had to have specific qualifications. So, like, one would have to be a biologist, one would have to be a sportsman, one would have to be a conservation organization person, and one would have to be an agriculture person. And so
it's a pretty broad spectrum.
Right. I mean, but right now there's no qualifications. And so there isn't even a requirement that there's a scientist on the commission, which seems a little crazy when you're talking about wildlife policy for the Department of Game and Fish. So, you know, I suspect that that bill will come up again, not next session because it's a short session and they can't hear bills like that. But in 2019, I would expect that. We're looking at ways to kind of expand the funding and scope of the Game and Fish Department so that they have authority and money to do more things, which is always helpful. So, yes, there will be opportunities at the state legislature level.
I'm just curious, in the previous legislatures, sessions, what was the support like for the changes to the Game Commission? Did it have legs? Did it have, like...
I think a bill like that just naturally takes a few cycles. It's pretty rare for a bill that kind of changes government structure to just go right away.
Yeah.
There have been a couple other bills to restructure some other commissions, like ISC and some of the tax boards. A lot of those are kind of at-will appointees by the governor. It doesn't work that well. So I think there's kind of broad talk that's gaining steam about the need to change the way all of those commissions are done. And Game Commission is certainly one that's on everybody's radar. I think, you know, one thing to press current gubernatorial candidates on is whether they would be willing to sign a bill that potentially took away their own power, because that's kind of the trick. It's a lot of power to get to appoint a lot of those commissions, and you'd need to find a governor that would be willing to let go of some of that in order to make the system more fair. So that's something that we're talking about a lot. But I think a lot of the legislators are really interested. That particular bill got through its first committee, but not its second. But the second committee, it didn't get through. People were concerned about monetary impacts. I think it was an evenly split committee, too, between Republicans and Democrats, which might have been part of why it didn't go.
You are listening to Earth Matters on KURU 89.1 FM, and we'll be right back after a quick break. Welcome back to Earth Matters on your Gila Members Community Radio Station, KURU 89.1 FM. My name is Nathan Newcomer, and I've been your host for today's show. We've been talking with G. Kalman, who is the staff attorney with the New Mexico Wilderness Alliance, on this show today about Mexican gray wolves and the efforts to try and save them from extinction, basically. So, Judy, I want to transition away from all the policy and the management plans that we've been talking about to, well, I guess another policy and management plan that the Forest Service is doing, and how wolves are sort of integral to forest planning. And we've heard that from some people that wolves should not be a part of the Gila National Forest plan revision process, but others would argue otherwise. Can you sort of give us a window into your thoughts on the relationship between forest plan revision and Mexican gray wolf recovery and management?
Sure. So each forest in the country every 20 years has to redo its management plan, which is sort of the bird's eye view plan of how they're going to manage their forest. So they have to look at all aspects of the forest and what they do on the forest and sort of decide where they're going to allow certain things to happen and where they're not going to allow certain things to happen, kind of management goals. And so the Gila, along with all four of our other forests in New Mexico, are all going through planning right now. And the Gila is kind of towards the beginning of that process. But I would definitely argue that wolves have to be an integral part of Gila forest management planning, just because what are you managing a forest for if not at least partially for a healthy ecosystem with healthy wildlife? And especially when you're talking about the Gila wilderness, you think of the wolf. And that's kind of an emblematic thing about the country's first wilderness area. It's what the Gila is for, wolves to be free, at least partly. And so, you know, it just doesn't make sense for the Forest Service to plan for forest management and not try to help wolves in the process. And on top of that, I would argue that they actually have a responsibility to do so under the Endangered Species Act, which kind of creates an obligation to work for endangered species recovery for all federal agencies.
So what would that look like in your mind? Because I'm also sort of having kind of a hard time visualizing how the Gila National Forest would put in sort of like prescriptions and guidelines for Mexican gray wolf recovery or management. Do you have any thoughts or ideas on what that might look like or ways that we might be able to encourage the Gila National Forest to tackle this issue within the plan revision?
I do. I might get in a little bit of trouble for it, but that's okay. I mean, there's a lot of case law out there regarding the Endangered Species Act that says that the Endangered Species Act should be the highest priority for every federal agency. And the Supreme Court has said that very clearly. And so if I was in charge of the Gila National Forest, which I'm not, you know, I would take that to heart. And endangered species would be the highest priority for forest management. So if that means, you know, recommending larger amounts of wilderness areas so that they have more habitat to go through, making sure that riparian areas are in better shape, making sure there are minimal conflicts with livestock, which is a big one down here. You know, there are ways to really work at minimizing those issues with cattle that the Forest Service can do. So I would look at all of those things and make sure that wolves were the priority.
Well, as our listeners will probably know through the conversations that I've had on this show many times about wilderness inventory work and the work that I've been doing, there is an opportunity for the Gila National Forest to recommend additional areas in the Gila as recommended wilderness.
Yeah, and it's important that they take that opportunity. You know, wolves in an ideal world don't want to be around people. They want to be out in a wilderness area where they can get elk. And
right.
So... you know, they're not interested in living in cities. They're interested in living in healthy ecosystems with plenty of prey. And so the way the Forest Service can ensure that that happens is to protect more areas as primitive areas and to make sure that all populations of wildlife can be at healthy, sustainable levels. And that helps predators like wolves and it helps tiny little invertebrates.
So, Judy, I'm kind of having a hard time trying to understand how the Forest Service would come up with prescriptions and guidelines in a forest plan revision to manage Mexican gray wolves. Do you have any ideas on how they can actually do that?
Yeah, so there's a really, really wonderful Supreme Court case called TVA versus Hill from 1978, if I could be really dorky for a second. But in it, there's this wonderful line that the Supreme Court said that the Endangered Species Act should be the highest priority for all federal agencies. It's a very oft-quoted section of that case, and it's been upheld many times over many Supreme Court cases ever since. And so I would say that, you know, the Forest Service has an affirmative obligation to treat endangered species as the highest priority for them, too. And, you know, that means doing whatever it can do to make sure that the Mexican wolf population is healthier and sustainable and can live for a long time. And so whether that means recommending additional areas for potential wilderness, which it has to do as part of this plan, whether it means making sure that riparian areas are healthy, making sure that, you know, there's a healthy prey population, whatever it is, especially things like minimizing cow-wolf interactions, which is possible to do through a forest plan. I think the Forest Service has an obligation to look at all of those things.
So our listeners will know about recommended wilderness because through conversations I've had on this show in the past about the work that I do on inventorying lands with wilderness characteristics, there's a lot of land out there that qualifies and could be designated as wilderness. How does that sort of tie in, though, with the Forest Service addressing specifically Mexican gray wolves? Or is it just sort of like an added kind of benefit? You see what I'm saying? Like they're required to do recommended wilderness, and by potentially recommending new areas as wilderness, that just in and of itself would help the Mexican gray wolf population? Or is there something more specific that could be done there?
Well, I think it would help in and of itself. You know, the wolf doesn't want to be near cities. It wants to be in giant wilderness areas where it can have a lot of prey that's healthy. A wilderness area that has minimal intervention by humans is the most perfect place that we have for a healthy prey population, a healthy ecosystem in general. And that's the place where wolves are going to want to be and they're going to want to thrive. So I think it has a direct connection.
Now, but the Forest Service probably won't be doing like a specific like section within the forest plan per se on Mexican gray wolves or wolf recovery.
Well, I'm encouraging them to do so. Okay. So hopefully they will.
Do you have any suggestions on what that might look like?
Well, like I said, I mean, I just think that they should look at all available science and look at their ecosystem. You know, this is the Gila Wilderness. It's emblematic of the American West. It's perfect for wolves. It's where wolves should be. And that's what people want to see and hear when they come to the Gila. And so it's totally integral with forest management. And so I just think that they need to look at doing everything they can do to help wolves in the forest planning process itself. And so, you know, it's probably going to be a multi-pronged thing, but I absolutely think that they should have a section on Mexican wolves in the forest plan. I think they're almost obligated to.
Well, let's hope they're listening to this show today. Are there any other things you want to share with our listeners about wolves, or can we switch to another topic I want to get on?
We can definitely switch to another topic.
So we've been seeing in the press lately, last couple of months, of attack on national monuments and this whole review process that's been going on by Secretary of the Interior Ryan Zinke. We've had a couple of people on the program on Earth Matters recently as well talking about this effort. Can you sort of give us an update on what's happened? Because I believe that something new has occurred from Secretary Zinke's office, and there was something that was leaked to the Washington Post maybe a week ago or...
Yeah, so Zinke's actual recommendations to President Trump were leaked to the press about a week ago, and they did include some boundary adjustments for some national monuments. None of those boundary adjustments were for New Mexico's monuments, but there was recommended management changes for our two national monuments.
Yeah, let's talk about those.
Yeah, so our two national monuments are pretty new. One is in 2013, and one was designated in 2014. Neither of those actually have management plans finalized yet. They're both in the process of getting those management plans written. And so it's a little unclear what Zinke's recommendations might mean because they're pretty vague in the document. And it just suggests management changes to ensure that things that have been occurring historically in those monuments continue to occur. So we can't really do anything except speculate until Trump actually makes a decision and acts on those. And it's unclear, you know, what his changes might actually be if he listens to Zinke's recommendations because they're so vague. So we're going to still have to wait and see before we make a decision on what to do. For now, you know, we're advocating to the Trump administration to not make any changes to the monument proclamations.
And that's what he would have to do, right? I mean, there's no other way for them to change the proclamations that President Obama signed into law without President Trump coming in and rewriting those proclamations, since we've never seen this happen
right,
before.
Right. I was just about to say that. This whole thing is totally unprecedented, and there's no right. known process for this. It seems like he would do it by executive order, and either that would be an executive order that sort of amends the existing proclamation, or he would rewrite the existing proclamations in the way that he wants to. I imagine those are the two most likely ways that it would happen.
Doesn't seem like that makes sense
you know,
at all.
Zinke's recommendations are very focused on allowing things like mining, logging, oil and gas drilling, that kind of thing. And, you know, part of both proclamations for Rio Grande del Norte and Organ Mountains Desert Peaks was the Monument Proclamation. So it specifically says that those areas cannot ever be leased for new uses like that. You know, existing leases could continue, but it removed them from possible new leasing. And so if that was really altered through Zinke's recommendations, I think we'd have a pretty major problem.
Now, so I remember looking at that Washington Post story, and I found a copy of the report, and I was flipping through it and reading about Rio Grande del Norte and Oregon Mountains. There were some outright falsehoods that were put into that report. And Senator Martin Heinrich actually grilled a BLM, I think it was a BLM employee, in Congress, in the Senate, about those falsehoods. And they just didn't seem to have any kind of response whatsoever, saying that they didn't review the report, they had no input in the report. Like, did they just make stuff up and just throw it in there?
I'm not sure how they got their information. It is pretty clear that there's some falsehoods. Zinke's recommendations were talking about, you know, roads being closed because of monument designation, which we've not found any evidence to confirm that at all, even after talking to BLM and the state land office. So it appears that that is false. He also mentioned grazing permittees not renewing their grazing lease because of monument designation, and we have no evidence that that's true either.
In fact, I think that those types of uses were written into the proclamation itself.
Oh, no, they definitely were.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, but at the same time, just because protection of those uses was written into the monument proclamation doesn't mean that the permittee has to continue. I mean, they could voluntarily withdraw their permit, and that's what he was saying happened, that they decided not to renew because of monument designation. But we have no evidence that that's true either. In fact, in Oregon Mountains Desert Peaks, I know for a fact from talking to the state land office that at least on state land, the only change to a grazing permit has been to increase one since monument designation. And none of them have been decreased. And I think the same thing is true on Rio Grande del Norte. So, you know, it seems like Zinke did not confer with BLM to get that information. And I would hope that before doing anything, somebody would correct that record, which I think is what Senator Heinrich was trying to do.
Now, what national monuments were specifically targeted in this report? Do you know?
The boundaries, you mean?
No, yeah,
or all of them?
Yeah, the national monuments that they wanted to reduce the size or get rid of.
So I think there were recommended changes to 9 out of the 27. 3 of those had boundary adjustments, and it was Bears Ears, Grand Staircase Escalante, and Grand Siskiyou.
Gold Butte, maybe?
Oh, maybe it was that one. Is that okay? Yeah. See, I'm paying so much attention to the New Mexico monuments that I don't know all the details about all the other ones. It might have been Gold Butte instead of Grand Staircase, one of those. And then Grand Siskiyou. The rest of them were proposed management changes, but all of them had really vague recommendations. So, you know, we'll just kind of have to see what happens.
Do we have any sort of sense on timing that the president might make a decision, that he sort of, in his executive order to do this initial review of national monuments, say that Secretary Zinke, you have to have this report done by this time, and then when you deliver it to me, I'll make a decision within 30 days or whatever?
The first part, yes, and the second part, no. So he required the recommendations to be in by August 24th, but did not give himself a deadline to act on them.
So it's just
kind of hanging out there, yeah.
Well, I'm just curious, you know, hearing it from a legal perspective, have you been talking with any other environmental attorneys and lawyers about if the president does decide to try and rescind national monuments or change boundaries, what we're going to do about that?
Yes. So there have been many West-wide conversations with many different parties, conservation groups and other groups and elected officials. And there have been lots and lots of strategy discussions about how that would go. I mean, everything has to be a little bit speculative just because we don't know exactly what is going to happen.
Sure.
I think if there were boundary adjustments to our monuments, we would certainly sue. That's kind of a no-brainer, and we've committed to doing that. You know, we worked really hard for those national monuments, and they have overwhelming public support, and every single acre in there deserves its protection, and we really believe that the president doesn't have authority to get rid of it. And so boundary adjustments are kind of a non-issue for us at this point in the sense of deciding whether or not to litigate. I think we just would. If there are recommendations to change management and that's what's acted on, I think we're just going to have to see what they are. I think something
specific,
like changing a mineral withdrawal that would potentially open our monuments up to mining, would be hard to ignore. You know, if it's something like enshrining current grazing levels at current levels, I don't know. So I think we're just going to have to see what happens.
Excellent. Well, is there anything else you want to share with our listeners about the whole national monument fiasco?
Call President Trump. But otherwise, no. I think that's where we are right now, is kind of urging him not to do it.
Well, Judy, thank you so much for joining us today on Earth Matters. It's been a real pleasure talking with you. It's nice to have you in the studio.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. As always, many thanks to Kyle Johnson, our technical engineer and all-around radio guru. I'd also like to thank all of our listeners for your support, feedback, and dedication to our community radio. You can tune in to Earth Matters every Tuesday, Thursday, and Sunday at 10 a.m. and Thursday evening at 8 p.m. on 89.1 FM, as well as listen to podcasts of each show at gmcr.org. Thank you so much, everyone. Have a great day.